Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, December 6th, 2009, and this is show number 236. We're heading into the holidays full steam here now, aren't we? One thing that bugs the daylights out of me is whenever I have a lot of time off, like, say, during the summer or over the holidays, most podcasters take a break and don't do a show. Right when I have some time to listen, they leave me high and dry. Well, I haven't had a break in the show in years, and I'm not about to start now. Luckily, my cohort in crime, Bart Bouchatz, is going to help me out. I'm going to be going on vacation where I don't have interweb access, and Bart is going to stand in on the show. That'll be the show that hopefully will come out on December 20th. I'd like to ask everyone to rally up, send in dumb questions for Bart, send in audio reviews to help him put the show together. He has lined up a secret co-host for Chit Chat Across the Pond, so that should be fun too. Go ahead and send things to me, and I'll be sure to get them on over to Bart. Last week, Kurt Beaver sent in a dumb question about how he and his buddy Tommy could use two USB mics to record a podcast together, sitting in the same room at the same time using one computer. Well, I came up with two ways to do it, and there are up a screen steps tutorials in the tutorials section on podfeet.com. I don't know if you've noticed, but I did a site redesign, and across the top now, there's a little menu pick you can click on for tutorials, and they're all in there. I got to finish sorting them out, but there's a section on audio, and it's in there. Well, one of my ideas was to use Audio Hijack Pro plus Soundflower. The other was to use simply Wiretap Studio. Both of them were reasonably simple, but did require a little bit of a financial investment, but pretty small. Nick Brennan wrote in and told me that Victor Cahiao actually covered the same exact idea over at typicalmacuser.com right around the same time, but he had a totally different solution and it doesn't cost a dime. The solution is to use a very underappreciated and practically hidden tool called Audio MIDI Setup that comes with Mac OS X. Audio MIDI Setup is in your Utilities folder inside Applications. The basic idea of all these solutions is that you need to combine two audio sources into one, otherwise known as aggregating them. As Victor's tutorial explains, you simply add a new audio device with the big plus button, and it automatically creates an aggregate device. And then it shows you all of the input devices from which you can choose to add to this aggregate device. Now, when you open a recording application like Wiretap Studio or GarageBand, you see aggregate device as the audio input source you can choose. All this sounded great until I tried doing it. I set the aggregate device to take in the Blue Icicle, that's the USB interface to my Heil PR20 mic, and I also had Steve Sampson CO1U plugged in, so I chose that as the other one for the aggregate device. I started with the Sampson as channel 1, and the Blue Icicle as channel 2. Did a quick recording with Wiretap Studio. The Sampson came through loud and clear, the one on channel 1, and I couldn't hear the Blue Icicle at all. I switched the order so the Blue Icicle was on channel 1, and guess what? I couldn't hear the Sampson at all. I eliminated the microphones from being at fault by doing that. I eliminated the cables, and it couldn't be any kind of volume setting on the Blue Icicle or anything like that. So the only thing that could be having a problem is the Audio MIDI setup software itself. I did try on Nick's suggestion, I tried using the display audio plus one of the USB mics, and it did work. So we're not really sure why, but it would not take two separate USB inputs. So go back to the tutorials and try those. Caleb Wong, also known as Geeko Supremo on Twitter. That's an awesome Twitter name, Caleb. Anyway, he sent in another path about Kurt's question about the two microphone inputs. Now, you remember, I said right off the top that I thought he should avoid using a mixer because A, it's expensive, and B, they're so confoundedly confusing. As I mentioned, my mixer has, at last count, I think about 236 dials on it, and it hurts my little head every time I try to use it. However, Caleb thinks the mixer is the way to go. I'm not going to read word for word everything he wrote because he goes into a lot of detail, but I put the full letter in the show notes, complete with links to the products Kurt describes. But here's the highlights from Caleb's email. He says, "While it is more expensive, I do recommend going for the mixer with XLR mics. You will not regret the quality of sound that you will get. Now, I know price is an obstacle, so I did a little looking and came up with the following setup. It isn't cheap, but it is inexpensive." He starts with an Alesis 2 mic mixer with USB interface built in, so it's about $80. They call it a four-input mixer because it also has two more line-level inputs on the board to the right of the mic channels, but you can ignore those. I put a picture in the show notes of what this little mixer looks like. So let me break in for a minute here. You should see this little baby mixer that Caleb suggests. It's just darling. It has a grand total of 14 dials on it. I know that sounds like a lot, but remember, mine has 348 dials, so this is really pretty manageable, I think. And if some of them had to have to do with that line in, I think that eliminates like four of them. So I think it's not that bad. I think if I'd started with this one, I might have been able to grow up someday to the big one I have now. Even with countless patient hours on Victor's part, it still baffled me most of the time. Caleb goes on to suggest three different microphone options. The Shure SM58s, the Sennheiser E835s, or possibly some lavalier mics from Audio-Technica. Now, I'm not sure I agree with him on that last option. I've talked to a lot of video guys like Sean Carruthers and Andy Walker of LabRaps.tv, and they say that unless you spend a lot of money on lavaliers, they're all garbage, and that even the really expensive ones break constantly. It's like one of the things they have to pay for. They figure like monthly they have to buy new ones. You can certainly try the ones Caleb suggests. They're only $30 each, so it's not a big gamble, but don't come crying to me if they fail on you. Next up, Caleb explains about the mic stands and mic cables Kurt would need for this operation. As I explained before, buying cables was really fun with my mixer. I now have a drawer full of them, and I feel fully equipped for any audio emergency. Many trips to Sam Ash came into that, and that's a really fun store to shop in. If you haven't been to one, just go check that out. Anyway, he goes through that and he adds up the damage from his ideas. So one of them, the mixer plus two mics plus two mic cables plus two stands, that comes to $322. Or the mixer plus the two lavalier mics would be a total of $140 plus shipping and handling. So he says, while not cheap, you can see that a good setup is not an arm and a leg, maybe just a kidney. Nice. He also passed along a little audio using his setup, which has a Sennheiser E835, a PreSonus FirePod, now the Fire Studio Project, and Wiretap Studio. He called GarageBand a sack of fail. The advantage of buying a FireWire interface is it allows for the two mics to be separate channels in the recording software. But if you do a good job on the mixer, the USB stereo output should be fine. Anyway, that's the end of the whole subject of two mics going into one computer.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, our old friend Jim Sewell, also known as Deveril on Twitter, wrote in with a dumb question. Here's what he said. Here's a dumb question for you. I came recently from the Windows world where weekly disk defrags are as much a routine as backups should be. I know it's not necessary to defrag my Mac because of the way it stores and retrieves data on the hard drive. My question is there any benefit to a Mac defrag? I would call you queen of the noobs, but it would come out wrong and sound like you're the chief noob instead of the one who is knowledgeable and helps out us noobs. Well, first of all, I like where you're going with the noob thing. How about if you call me the great noob queen? That sounds about right. Anyway, on to your question. I started to write to you that I didn't know exactly why you don't need to defrag a Mac, but I remembered reading something somewhere that was brilliantly written, but I was too lazy to go find it. And then I did like a 30-second Google search, and I rediscovered the brilliant article. It was by Apple. I'll put a link in the show notes to the full article in the support.apple.com webpages, but here's the major points, or at least the parts of it that I understood. I skipped the ones I didn't understand. All of this has to do with OS X and does not apply to the old OS 9. OS X's extended formatting, that's HFS Plus, avoids reusing space from deleted files, so it doesn't jump into every little empty spot as it gets freed up. Fragmentation used to be caused by appending data to existing files as they changed, but with faster and faster hard drives and better caching, it turns out that most applications can rewrite the entire file every time you save, so it doesn't get fragmented. Like I said, that's the parts I understood. There's a lot more in the article that I didn't follow, but you can read all of it for yourself if you find that subject fascinating. I hope that puts your mind at rest and you don't have to defrag. Every time I think Screen Steps is as cool as it will get, the developers take it up a notch. I just watched a video on their website where Trevor demonstrated a cool new feature of Screen Steps when uploading lessons to your blog. Not going to tell you all about it because it's way more interesting watching Trevor explain it, But that's just a teaser. On Tuesday, December 8th, from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, they'll be hosting a webinar entitled Advanced WordPress with Screen Steps and Screen Steps Live. Whenever I watch one of their webinars and participate in the live chat, I learn a ton. And you'd think at this point, I already know everything about Screen Steps by now, right? No, not true. Learn something every single time. I get better and better at using this tool every time I watch one of the webinars. I put a link in the show notes to the demo and seminar registration so you can go to it too. You definitely should check it out. If for some weird reason you don't already own Screen Steps, I think there's like three of you guys left. Anyway, go to this link. Go to the link at screensteps.com, download the free trial, and then when you go buy it, be sure to use the NOCILLA coupon code, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price. Last week, I gave my review of Windows 7, and while I did acknowledge it has some huge improvements over Vista, one thing they didn't change, and I was really wishing they would have, was the behavior of Windows with respect to scrolling. On OS X, if you hover over a window, that window kind of gains focus, so you can scroll without actually having to click on it. That's handy if you have like two windows, one slightly under the other one, and you're trying to see something in the underneath window at the same time you're working in the upper window. It's real handy to be able to scroll that without clicking on it, because if you click it, then it covers up the first window. I was hoping that Windows 7 would have that feature, but it doesn't. Great news, though. Geeta and Connor both came through with options to solve this problem. Geeta suggested software called WizMouse, WizMouse, from Antibody Software, from antibody-software.com. WizMouse is freeware with a pretty easy license, mostly just protects themselves, and no restriction on commercial use. WizMouse instantly gave me the freedom to scroll over any open window and have it obey my command. This makes me ludicrously happy. It's as though I've been released from some sort of bonds. That was extremely cool, but there was another side benefit. For some reason, there are some mutant programs on Windows that don't actually support a scroll wheel. You have to actually grab the scroll elevator to do it or click in the scroll window. Luckily, most applications don't act like this, but if you're unlucky enough to use one of these mutant applications, it's going to drive you crazy. Somehow, WizMouse is able to actually talk these applications into obeying your scroll wheel. They do give you an option to disable that functionality just in case your application acts hinky when you turn it on. This is my new favorite Windows application. It works on Windows 2000, XP, Vista, and Windows 7. Whee! Thanks so much, Geeta. That was awesome. Connor's solution was called CatMouse. That's K-A-T-M-O-U-S-E. I like saying that. M-O-U-S-E. Anyway, from, oh boy, this can be tough to pronounce. Ehiti, E-H-I-T-I .de/CatMouse. There's a link in the show notes. Anyway, he heard about it from Steve Gibson on Security Now. He gave me a hard time for not listening to Security Now myself, but I got to tell you, Steve Gibson is a sweet, nice man. I've met him a couple of times. He even posed for pictures with me, the whole thing. But my brain just goes dead when he's talking about security. I just can't listen to it. I should, I know, but I can't. Okay? So anyway, set that aside. While CatMouse does allow you to scroll over a window that's underneath a front window, it seemed to scroll farther than I'd expect. It was almost like it had momentum, but not when I fling it, just during normal scrolling. A little bit weird behavior. CatMouse also had a lot of other functionality that I simply don't understand. There's just all these different things you can do with it. There's like four tabs and 14 different controls and stuff. First, you decide what button will be the push button, defaulting to the scroll wheel itself. Then there's a whole section on raising a window in Z order by holding the push button and setting how many milliseconds to raise it after holding for... What? It hurts. Then it talks about holding the push button and pressing the left-right mouse button and how that affects the mouse cursor page-wise. Page-wise? What are you talking about? I got lost here and I gave up. Finally, CatMouse doesn't support two-fingered scroll, but WizMouse does. I do appreciate that Connor sent CatMouse along, but it's a bit more complicated than I wanted. In fact, it seems just like something Steve Gibson would really, really like. Turns out WizMouse, the one Geeta recommended, solves just the one problem with the added bonus of automatically allowing applications to scroll with a mouse that don't normally support that activity. I didn't have to configure anything to get that extra feature. WizMouse from Antibody Software is perfect for me. Thanks to both Geeta and Connor for sending in these solutions. This week has been an emotional roller coaster for me on one technology bit of news. Back in April, I told you about an outstanding new service that called Etherpad. It was back on show number 198. The idea is that you click one button on etherpad.com, no login required, and it creates what's called an Etherpad. You send the URL for the Etherpad to the people you want to collaborate with, and then all of you can start typing on this webpage all at the same time. Think of it like as a wiki, but no saves required, and it's not restricted to one person working on it at a time. I convinced the Mac Roundtable to use this for our show notes, and it's been fantastic. We used to have some poor sod assigned to the show notes. If I was on the show, it was usually me. And I'd spend a long time after the show tracking down all the links people talked about, the products, trying to reconstruct what we said. Now with the Etherpad, people fill in them real time while they're working, and when the show is done, so are our notes. You'll notice the notes are getting better. We're getting a lot more links and a lot more text in there. There's even a built-in chat window so that we can talk to each other while we're working on the show. So let's say somebody's audio's gone wonky. You can say, hey, you know, your audio's wonky, and they'll, you know, be able to go, okay, I'm going to get off the call and come back or whatever. Sometimes we use that area to suggest we move on to the next topic. It works flawlessly, and we just love it. There's all kinds of cool export options. You can export it to HTML, Word if you wanted to, I don't know why, and a bunch of other stuff. You can save revisions as you go along. I mean, it's just, it color codes as people are working on it. I love Etherpad. So what was the roller coaster? Well, earlier this week, I got a technology alert from the Wall Street Journal that Etherpad had been purchased by Google. My first, actually, it's AppJet. AppJet's the company that makes Etherpad. So it was AppJet. But anyway, my first response was pure delight for the people at AppJet because they have a great service and they were being rewarded for it. I was so happy for them. My next emotion was sheer sadness when I read their blog post where they announced that no new pads could be created and that by March of next year, they would shut down the service. Wailing ensued. Well, I eventually got over it and I moved on with my life. Then I was a little happy again when I read that Etherpad will become part of Google Wave. This is great news for Wave because maybe you could actually use it for something. Right now, it's still kind of a novelty that appears to serve no real purpose. It would be a useful thing, actually, if it had Etherpad functionality. And, you know, eventually that would come along, and I thought at least I had hope now. And then this morning, Niraj sent me yet another link to the Etherpad blog where they explained that this huge hue and outcry, they're not shutting down the service. Instead, they're going to open source the project. This is the best of all possible news. Not only will the product continue to exist, but maybe it'll even get enhancements if anyone picks up the project. But we also get the functionality moving into Google Wave. Great news all around. See why I said it was an emotional roller coaster? I just got something really fun for my MacBook Pro. Pat Dengler, the Mac Doctor, pointed me to trickimages.com. They sell these really cool vinyl stickers for your laptops. Now, the really cool ones they had were of Snow White. You put it situated so she was holding the Apple logo. Way cool. So obviously the trademark fools made them take that down. Well, Pat suggested, though, that it would be appropriate for me to have an image of a microphone on my Mac. Even though this company is outside of the U.S., I got free shipping. It came in just a couple of days, and it was only 10 pounds, which is around $16. It looks really great. I put a picture in the show notes so you can see how cool it is. Thanks for the tip, Pat. So last week, Kyle's car exhibited a strange behavior. Sitting at idle, the engine would rev itself up to really high RPMs, then wind down and wind back up again, straining against the brakes when we were sitting still. Now, for normal people, this would mean making arrangements for when you can drop off the car at the mechanic shop, getting someone to drive you to work, and then back to the shop, and probably being late to work and leaving early on the other end. And it means getting a second loan on your house to pay for the repairs. But that's not what happens at our house. One quick call to Honda Bob, he diagnosed the problem over the phone, correctly, of course, and made arrangements to come over at a time that was convenient for us on Sunday. Oh, he also set our minds at ease, saying it wasn't really going to hurt the engine to continue to drive it. Even better, after he did the repairs, he gave us a report on every single repair we've had on this 1990 Accord. This sucker's coming up on 10 years old. The total we have spent is $1,530 in 10 years. Amazing. Now, we don't drive it real far. It's only been 58,000 miles in 10 years, but still, that's pretty cheap. If you'd like this in-home service on your Honda or Acura, and you live in the LA or Orange County areas, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hebob@aol.com. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, Honda Worldwide. Oh, one more thing. Honda Bob asked me to tell you to check out his playlists on his website over at hdabob.com. They're under From Bob in the menus. It's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you this fine day, Bart?
I'm grand. Fine is an interesting term, but I guess it wasn't raining. It was just bloody cold. really windy.
Yesterday, Steve and I got up and we went out to go to the gym, and it was, oh, it was freezing outside. We could see our breath. And then I checked the temperature and we were 2 degrees colder than the July high in Ireland.
Yeah.
We're a bunch of pansies.
You're just not used to like real weather.
I had to wear a long sleeve shirt to go jogging today on the beach. I know. It was dreadful. We're suffering bad. We might light a fire today, you know.
That's cozy.
Yeah. All right, let's kick into Security Light, shall we?
Okie dokie. First up, it's that time of the month where we get our advance notification that next Tuesday is Patch Tuesday. Microsoft are never very specific about what it is they're going to do, because otherwise the attackers know too much. So basically, there's a bunch of updates coming, some of them rated critical, and there's some in Windows and some in Office.
Oh.
So okay. Bulletin 1 is rated critical for remote code execution, and that affects Microsoft Windows. Bulletin 3, why are these out of order? It's typical of Microsoft.
Bulletin 3 same reason also shutdowns under start, Bart.
Yes, that's it. So the 3 is, again, critical remote code execution, but that one's for Office. Then 4 is critical remote code execution, but that one's for Windows and Internet Explorer. Then we have a denial of service, i.e. blue screen of death, for Windows. And then we have another remote code execution for Windows and a remote code execution for Windows and Office.
Nice. Whose version of Office? It's platform agnostic?
It just says affected software Microsoft Windows. And that's all it says.
No, but under Office, does it say whether it's Office for the Mac or Windows or both? Or
not in the executive summary, which is the only bit that ever makes any sense to me.
Okay. I this is a side load, but I heard Paul Theriot on Windows Weekly talking about how it really irritates him that Office on the Mac is almost Office, that, you know, it's not really Office. And he says, if I wanted almost Office, I'd be running Open Office. So why don't you just give us real Office? But I guess there is a new version coming.
I'm not so sure. I tend to like my products to be customized to the Mac way of doing things rather than the Windows way of doing things. I think the ribbon is the biggest pile of UI barfing on this entire planet.
How much have you actually used it, though? I think it's a completely different way of getting to the problem, but I'm starting to warm to it, Bart. I've started using it for a couple
Microsoft
months now.
Way. Information overload, and we'll have it constantly changed so nothing's ever in the same place, because goodness me, you wouldn't want to develop any muscle memory.
No. It's the other way around. It's only show you the information that's relevant to what you're doing.
It shows loads of stuff, and then you have to click into it, and then it shows something else. Like, my dad showed it to me as a demo. I went, look, you click here, and then you see these options, and then you click here, and then you see these options. I went,
No. But, I mean, like, you get into formatting something, all of a sudden you've got all the format stuff right there on the toolbar at the same time. So instead of having to go find the menu in which you would add a drop shadow, it's right there in front of you. So I wouldn't judge it based on seeing a demo. I would judge it based on using it for a while. The theory behind it was to uncover a lot of things that people would call in and request as enhancements that were already in the product, but nobody knew because the menus were just so vast. You know, it's a huge program. So now you get access to a lot more rich data rich application tools that you wouldn't have. You wouldn't even realize were there. I'm still getting used to it. I'm not completely sold, but I don't know. I kind of like it, Bart.
It's for most people.
Well, and the keys,
people who like
the keystrokes are still the keystrokes are still there.
I just want my screen back. Take away the junk.
Well, I want my vertical screen back. That's the thing that's driving me crazy. We're all going widescreen, and every menu's on the top. Could you put some crap on the left for me? I got a big widescreen here.
Exactly. Anyway.
Okay. Oh, was that the subject? So the bottom line is launch your virtual machines, upgrade your Windows, and close them back down again. Keep an eye out for the Office update. And if you're running Windows, make sure Windows Update is running automatically, right?
Yes, but do it after Tuesday.
Oh, after Tuesday. Okay, sorry.
No point in doing it before the updates are out.
Alrighty.
Okay, so we also have an update from our friends in Apple. A few weeks ago, we mentioned that there was a Java update for everyone except for OS X users, and it affected a whole bunch of nasty critical security stuff, and Mac users were left vulnerable for what I said would probably be weeks. Well, it was only weeks rather than months this time. So we have an update from Apple now for Snow Leopard and for Leopard, but not for Tiger.
Oh.
So I think that confirms my previous fear. Tiger dead.
Dun, 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 dun. It's over.
Exactly.
Huh?
Yeah, Tiger is over. So if you're running either of the now current OS X's, allow software update to run, especially if you ever use the internet.
Okay.
And that's it. Well, that's all that crossed my radar. So I hope that's it.
All right. What's our main topic for today?
Okay, excuse me. Our main topic for the day is another one of those. Let's get back to basics so that we can properly explain something we've mentioned 10 squillion times.
So this is a big long tease before you're going to get to what we're talking about?
Well, kind of. Okay. I wasn't going to tease for very long.
Oh, okay.
Last week, or was it last week? When did we talk about all the SSL stuff? And actually, I think that was when we were answering Steve's dumb question, so wasn't it?
Which is last week then, yeah.
We always mention these things like, and if someone manages to either be a man in the middle or manages to poison your DNS, then they can do. And then we sort of leave it at that. But we talked about the man in the middle stuff in quite some detail when we were talking about Wi-Fi and why it's dangerous and so forth. But we didn't really talk about exactly what it means for someone to poison your DNS cache and how they might do that and anything about it or how you might protect yourself. So I figured we'd have a little look at DNS and then get to what triggered me to do this week, which is a new service that's available, which I'm using, and others may be interested as well.
Okay.
So, first off, what is ZDNS? Well, it stands for the Domain Name System, which probably isn't that much help to people. But what it does is it turns nice names, like podfeet.com, into IP addresses like 64.202.163.103.
Is that the real one?
It is the real one, yeah. If you ever want to find a DNS and you're on a Mac, you just go into the terminal and type host space the domain name and it'll resolve it for you.
Yeah.
Which is a handy little terminal command. So computers can only talk between IP addresses and humans are terribly bad at remembering IP addresses and they'd much rather work in domains. So in order to bridge the human-computer divide, we have the DNS system.
It's sort of like a phone book then. I look up, Allison Sheridan in the phone book and I find her address in Alabama. Or whatever.
Yeah, in many ways it's a simple lookup where it's a hierarchical lookup rather than a simple lookup, and exactly how it works in terms of which server is responsible for what can get a bit complex. But ultimately, you issue a DNS request which says, I want to know what IP address belongs to this name, and a DNS server answers with, here it is, and then your computer can actually do the communication you want, be that send an email, load a web page, make a connection over FTP, I mean, pretty much anything that ever involves a domain name to DNS service has to resolve it.
Okay.
So it's pretty important.
Yeah. I want that.
Yeah, exactly. We want that. DNS is also pretty old. It's been around pretty much since the dawn of the internet because people have never been good at remembering IP addresses and have never thought that was a particularly good solution. But because it's old, it has two effects. First off, it was designed to be really efficient because old hardware was crap hardware. And secondly, it predated the notion that anyone could possibly want to abuse the internet.
Yeah, this those days.
Yeah, this dates back to the days when the internet was between like a few universities and the military, and it was run out of ARPA, or DARPA, whatever it's called, the Defense Advanced Research something program.
Right?
Agency?
Agency.
Anyway, program agency, actually, I think. PA at the end. Anyway, it's really old. And in them days, no one thought that anyone would ever abuse the internet. They were kind of in shock that they could actually make computers talk to each other. So the novelty was, oh my God, it works, rather than we need to make this secure. So that, of course, has become an issue in the modern world, where we're not at all in shock that the internet works, but people are very much abusing it.
Right.
So, the other thing we need to note is that they do a lot of stuff to make it more efficient, but one thing in particular they do to make it more efficient is there's caching all over the place. Because it's much less work just to give an answer from a cache than it is to go and look it up again.
Okay, and a cache is just like a temporary storage on your computer of what it's looked up before?
Yeah. Well, yeah, or DNS servers will have a cache, your local computer will have a cache, every name server will have a cache, so you could be getting a cache from anywhere along the line.
Not necessarily on my computer, someplace else too. Okay, got it.
Yeah. I mean, you as a home user would be using your ISP's DNS server most likely.
Mm-hmm.
So they would cache anything that anyone else on your ISP has looked up.
Oh, okay.
So that means you tend to get much quicker answers because chances are someone else has been to CNN.com before you want to go there.
Ah, okay.
So instead of your ISP server having to look it up, which is an iterative process, it would look up who is responsible for com, then who is responsible for CNN, and then it would ask that server for the answer. So there's a couple of requests to get an answer. But if it has a cache, yeah, it just gives you the answer. There you go. It's way easier.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, so the way it works, you do something which means that DNS has to be invoked, and your computer sends out a DNS request to its DNS server, and in that request, you say what it is you're looking for, as in what name, and what record about that name you'd like to get. And usually that means either an A record if you're trying to do anything except for email, and an MX record if you're trying to do email.
Okay, so if I'm just trying to go to the website, that's considered an A record.
Yeah, everything except for email, unless you're doing something really bizarre and weird that you're really not likely to be doing, is an A record.
Okay.
And anything else is an MX record, probably. So it just says, I'd like podfeet.com and I'd like the A record for it, please. It also inserts a sequence number, which is chosen by whoever is initiating the request. And then it farms it off to whatever its DNS server is. And then the DNS server has to do its bit of work. And when it's all good and done, the DNS server is going to give you back an answer. And the answer is just a single response which contains a copy of your question. It contains the answer. It gives you back your own sequence number you gave it in the first place. And it also contains something called a TTL, or time to live, which is the way computer scientists say, how long may I cache this?
Do I care what sequence number means?
It becomes important later on, but for now we don't. It's a number.
Okay.
So I give the server what domain I want, what about it I want, and my sequence number. And then it gives me back as an answer the question I asked, the answer, my sequence number back, and a TTL. And the TTL is just an amount of time this is allowed to be cached for.
Okay.
So if you're running a domain and you want to keep your server from being too busy, you'd set a really high TTL so that people wouldn't be annoying you all the time. But if you're about to change, say, your hosting, you'd set a really, really low TTL and leave it there for a few days so that no one has any cache of your domain. Then you change your domain to, you know, you move it to a new hosting provider, and then you can put the TTL on again. So you may, there's legitimate reasons to want to control the TTL.
All right. A regular human would not, but...
Well, yeah, there's reasons a sysadmin would want to control the TTL. But really, the only thing we care about the TTL is that it's a value that gets sent in the response that says, you may cache this for X minutes.
Okay.
Or I think it might even be in seconds. But anyway, for X time, that's all that matters. So, the important thing to note is that the receiving server knows what query is being answered by the sequence number. Because it's going to be sending out thousands of requests a second and getting back thousands of answers, and it uses the sequence number to associate an answer with a question.
And the server we're talking about, again, is the DNS server I'm using, say, at Comcast or wherever.
Yeah, whoever your ISP is. So your browser has contacted their DNS server. Their DNS server may have to do some work, but in the end, it's going to get an answer, and it's going to give the answer back to you.
Based on the sequence number.
And that sequence number is going to tell your computer which answer that belongs to. So your web browser may have made a request and your mail client may have made a request. So your computer has to know which answer is for who, or you're going to send your email to the wrong person and go to the wrong web page.
Okay, makes sense. I'm with you.
So we need to get a little geeky for a moment.
Uh-oh, I thought we were already.
I know, this is as bad as it gets.
Okay.
Let me come back up. So the vast majority of stuff you do on the internet is over something called TCP, which is just a protocol called Transmission Control Protocol. And it has loads of advantages. It's a really good protocol. One of the things it does is it makes it impossible to spoof IP addresses, although, of course, we do know that someone else can pretend to be you on the LAN, but we'll ignore that.
Okay.
And it does this basically by doing what's called a three-way handshake. And there's a bunch of stuff that happens to make sure that no one can pretend to be another IP address. So you know you're talking to that other IP address.
I think that's the first time I've ever heard you say a protocol or a service is actually good and has lasted a long time. Usually it's like it was invented before evil existed and that sort of thing. So it's nice to hear something is good. TCP/IP is good.
Yeah, TCP has served us really well. TCP is a good protocol. I mean, it's been extended in some ways so that you can add in encryption and stuff, but TCP is a good protocol. And it has lots of advantages. So the first thing is it does this three-way handshake so that you really know you're talking to who you think you're talking to, which is nice. And it also does a whole bunch of fancy error checking to make sure that every bit of data that goes into a TCP connection comes out the other end, and it also comes out the other end in the right order, which is kind of nice.
Okay.
Because when you communicate over the internet, it's broken into little chunks called packets, and each packet fends for itself, and some of them get chewed up by routers, and some of them get there faster than other ones. So not all packets will arrive, and they may arrive in a random order. So it's the job of TCP to reassemble everything on the other end, and maybe to send back a request saying, can you send that again, because it seems to have gone missing. And it gets all the pieces, reassembles it into the right order, and gives it back, so that when you view a web page, it's not a jumble.
All right.
It's a good thing.
Okay.
But the downside is there's a lot of overhead going on here. So you've got to build the connection, send the data, and dismantle the connections. And building the connection involves lots of negotiation. Actually sending the data involves lots of verification. Did you get that? Yeah, I got that. Actually, no, will you send that again? I mean, there's lots of stuff going on. Then when you're done, you have to take down the connection, which involves another exchange of packets. So there's a lot of work going on there, which is fine if you're sending, you know, 5 gigs. Well, not 5 gigs. Even if you're sending a few hundred K, that overhead is like 1% or something. But DNS is really small and efficient. It's actually a single packet.
Oh.
A DNS request is one packet, and a DNS response is one packet. So if you built up a connection that takes a couple of packets to set up the connection, sent the one packet, and had a little bit of over and back to make sure the one packet made it in the right order, and then dismantled the connection, you're literally talking about 7, 8, 900% inefficiency.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
So on old hardware, on the old internet, that was just considered insanity. So they didn't use TCP.
Uh-oh. So the only thing that was good...
Yeah, they didn't use it because, well, it has a big overhead. If you're only sending, you know, if you're sending a few hundred K, it's great. If you're sending one itty-bitty packet, it's a bit much, like... So they used a different protocol called UDP, which is the Unified Datagram Protocol, I think. I'm just pretty sure that's what it is. I remember doing that in college a few years ago. But anyway, the point of UDP is it doesn't do connections. It just fires off a packet onto the internet and hopes it gets there. Skype uses UDP as well.
Oh, okay.
Which is why you sometimes have Skype calls breaking up. That's just when some of the UDP packets get lost.
Oh, okay. I remember seeing in my router when I'd be trying to configure a port to send for gaming or something like that, I had a choice of TCP or UDP or both, and I never knew what it was, so I checked them both.
Yeah, you're always safe that way. A lot of games would use UDP as well because they just want to get really fast frame rates and they don't care if the odd frame gets lost.
Uh-huh.
So TCP will make sure everything gets there, but it's slow, whereas UDP is just sort of, we'll do my best, I'll send it out on the internet, and I hope it gets there. But it also has the downside that there hasn't been this connection handshake, so there's no way to know what really came from who you say it came from. Anyone can send out a UDP packet and stick anyone's from address on it, and it's not in any way verifiable.
That doesn't sound like a good thing.
No, because that leads to the problem that what we happen for DNS is one packet gets sent out with a request, and then one packet gets sent back with a response. What if someone else sent back a packet with a response?
And you haven't got a sequence number or anything to match it against?
Well, okay, you do have a sequence number, so that adds in a minor difficulty, but not as big a difficulty as you'd think.
Okay.
So what would happen is you'd send out a packet, the attackers would send back a packet, and if their packet got back before the real packet got back, the DNS server would take the attacker's packet and go, oh, okay. And then the attacker gets the choice of the TTL. So they can say, cache this for a month, please.
Oh.
And they've given the wrong answer.
Oh, okay.
So they get to give the wrong answer and they get to say how long you keep the wrong answer.
Okay.
So that means they've poisoned your cache. Because the next time anyone looks for that domain, it's cached. And its TTL is still good.
Oh,
have the wrong answer again. And again. Okay. And everyone else sharing your ISP, you can have the wrong answer too.
Everyone so, sharing the... Oh, okay. Right. Because
so
we
everyone
said...
Everyone using that server, the server has been poisoned. It's going to keep that cache until the TTL expires.
How does a bad guy get it in there in the first place, though?
They just bombard packets at it. So, okay, so in theory, the simplest possible attack you could do is just keep sending packets over and over again with random sequence numbers and hope that someone does a request for the domain you want to poison and that your packet arrives at the right time. And if you do that for a month, you will manage to poison the cache eventually.
Because you guess right on the sequence
eventually
number?
You're going to guess right, yeah.
Oh, okay.
If you try to poison a big domain like google.com that you know is going to be looked up all the time, and you keep firing packets at it with ever-changing sequence numbers, it is going to happen that you override the right sequence number when the server is actually expecting a response for Google.
Ah.
It will eventually work. It's not very efficient, but it'll work. So the first way you protect yourself is by using the sequence number. Initially, when these attacks first started, the sequence number lived up to its name. It was a sequence. It went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Let me guess, they started randomizing it after a while.
Yeah. So what the attackers would do, because what you need to do to really have a chance of success is not just to hope someone looks up your domain and that you then get to poison it. You force them to. So maybe you send out a phishing email with a link in it, and that link is going to trigger a DNS request, and that's the domain you're trying to poison. Maybe you buy an ad and you stick in a graphic that goes to the domain you're trying to poison, and you also stick in a graphic that goes to a domain you control. Then first there's a request fired off to your server, so you know there's one about to be signed off to the one you're attacking. So then you start sending packets back. Hmm. So at least you know the request is, you know, the attack is doable. And then you just start guessing sequence numbers. But before they were randomized, you didn't even have to guess. Because there was a request went to you, and then straight away a request went to the one you're trying to attack. You just add one onto the sequence number, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Right, I was going to say a 10 if you're, slow. Yeah.
So you just have to fire off a couple of packets and hey presto, you're done.
Okay.
So it didn't take long for people to realize that maybe we should change the sequence number. And so the first thing that was done to make DNS less prone to attack is they randomized the sequence number.
And these are now big numbers, I assume.
Well, they can't be too big because they have to fit into the one packet.
Okay. But
it adds a bit more work to do. So now,
I mean, they're not like 1, 2, 3, 4. They're like five digits or something. Or
I don't know quite how many bytes there, but yeah, they're big enough numbers. It's certainly into the hundreds of thousands.
Okay.
And so now, although you can trigger a request, you now have to send back a few hundred thousand packets before the real answer gets back to really have a chance of spoofing it. So you've made it a bit harder. But Dan Kaminsky recently. You remember we had this big, the world is coming to an end because of DNS?
Yeah, that was him.
Dan Kaminsky found a way for you to trigger lots and lots of requests so you could really hammer at the server much more easily. Instead of waiting for them to issue another request, you could really make them issue loads and loads. And the more requests they're issuing, the easier it is for you to drop in the poison.
Okay.
So he made it, basically he made it easier. So suddenly that wasn't enough randomness anymore.
So it used to take I do remember that discussion.
To guess
right.
The sequence number, uh-huh. And suddenly that wasn't random enough anymore. You could guess the sequence number in a couple of minutes because of what Kaminsky discovered. So you needed more random. We need more random. This has to get harder. So what Dan Kaminsky said is if you want to be safe, you now need to go even further on the randomness and you now need to randomize the source port. So if you make a connection, you say, I'm connecting from this IP address on this port to that IP address on that port. And if you send a UDP packet, it has a from header which says IP address and port, and a to header which says IP address and port. The to address has to be on port 53 because that's where web servers live. But the from address can be anything. So the simple answer was to make the request from a different random port every time. So now you have to guess the port to send it back to and the sequence number.
So now your probability is pretty low in succeeding there, right?
You've just gone down. But remember, the internet is constantly getting faster. So the more bandwidth you have, the more packets you can send. So even that only gives you protection of a few days. But of course, there should be a lot of traffic generated by this. So if your sysadmin is awake, your sysadmin should notice that there's this massive sea of DNS packets coming in and they're all full of errors.
Right.
And that should
raise
a
little bit of a hint.
It should be a little bit of a hint, assuming your ISP is awake.
Okay.
May not always be.
So we're safe now then. All this scary stuff you've been telling us, we're safe? We're good?
We're safe. We're kind of okay for now. It's not too bad. Assuming your ISP has implemented port randomization. And even 6 months after the Kaminsky attack was made public, there were still ISPs not doing source port randomization.
Okay.
Which is not good. In the future, we have a real solution rather than just throwing more randomness at it and hoping for the best. The real solution is probably going to be a new protocol, and the leading contender is something called DNSSEC, which is a secure version of DNS that uses digital signatures to verify answers. So it's basically based off the same technology as SSL.
Hmm. Okay.
And that will be actually secure cryptographically. But that's going to be a couple of years away. Oh. So in the meantime...
See, you keep getting me excited, and then you just pull the rug right out from under me. No, I thought that was going to be the answer today.
Well, no, DNSSEC is coming, but we can't implement that. And that's going to take years for everyone to switch to DNSSEC. So for now, we just need to throw in lots and lots more randomization. It's a stopgap measure, but it works. So, to be safe, you depend on your ISP. You depend on your ISP to definitely be doing source port randomization, and you can be pretty sure of that unless your ISP has teleported in from the 70s. So you can probably count on that. They should also, to keep you even remotely safe, they absolutely need to be doing source port randomization as well as the sequence number randomization. And they're not all doing that. But they really should be by now because the Kaminsky attack has been out for bloody ages.
I mean, even I know about it.
Yeah, so really they should be doing that, but you may be surprised at how bad some ISPs are. So ultimately, you're probably better off finding a DNS provider you trust that you know has implemented all of these features.
Okay.
If you ring up your ISP and ask them how their DNS server is configured, I don't think you'll get a sensible answer out of the person on the other end of the phone.
So I do remember a while ago, this is a couple of years ago, but I had trouble. I wasn't able to connect to websites. And I remember, I think I probably somehow got a hold of you, and because I knew I was on the internet because I was able to chat with you. And you gave me a couple of IP addresses and I was able to connect to those websites. And that's where we put it together and said, okay, well, there's a problem with your DNS servers at your ISP. And so I contacted a buddy of mine and I got his DNS servers from his ISP and boom, I was online and I was fine. So like you say, I called up my ISP and I told them and they said, oh no, you just don't know what you're talking about. And the guy was an idiot.
That's just simply saying your DNS is broken. Imagine trying to ask them how it's configured.
Maybe not.
Yeah, they'll just say, very well, thank you, and leave it at that. So do you trust that they are doing source port randomization, that they are also doing the sequence randomization, and that their sysadmins are watching the network to look for spikes in DNS traffic that could mean you're under attack? If you don't trust them, take matters into your own hand. Don't trust your ISP.
Take control, huh?
Take control.
Okay. Right?
And you can choose what DNS settings you tell your router to use. So I used to always recommend a service called OpenDNS.
Ah, and I have OpenDNS. You must have told me that.
I did, yes.
Okay.
And OpenDNS are very much ahead of the ball. They were already doing source port randomization before Dan Kaminsky said, you really have to do source port randomization.
Oh,
so
okay.
They were on the ball.
Okay.
But they're funded by ads. And the way they make you see the ads is by breaking the actual official DNS specification. What should happen when you try to look up a domain that doesn't exist because either you've done a typo or it just doesn't exist is that the DNS packet that comes back should not say success, have an IP address, but it should say failure and give you an error message. But what OpenDNS do is they send back success and they give back their own IP address and send you to a page full of ads.
Well, they don't. Okay, technically, I'm sure success is in there somewhere, but it also says, you didn't get where you wanted to go. Here's some options. And by the way, here's some ads.
The web page says that.
Right.
But the DNS answer, the DNS packet return is a success packet, which is why your browser then loads the web page.
Okay, but why is that
fail? It wouldn't load anything.
But why is that a problem to me? I'm getting a free service out of these guys. This is the way they're funding themselves. They do tell me you made a typo, you moron, and I have the option of going in and doing it correctly. It doesn't hurt me, does it?
It does, because good browsers like Firefox don't give up the first time they get an error. They say, "Well, you may have made a typo." So they try a few different permutations until they get a success.
Okay.
And if
all
else fails, then they give you an error.
Yeah.
But if you're using Firefox, then they get a success back. So Firefox dutifully displays
You're right.
Isn't a success.
Because every once in a while I go up to the URL bar and I just type Podfeet and hit a carriage return or Google and hit a carriage return. And it used to go, oh, you silly thing. I know what you meant and put me to the right place.
Yeah. And the way it does that is it sends off the request you sent, gets back an error from DNS, and then appends com and tries again, which means it will work.
Mm.
But if it gets back a success, it's not going to do the second, and so it's going to send you to the wrong page. So anything that relies on DNS getting an accurate answer will never get an accurate answer. So on a web page, that's not too bad, because like you say, it gives you the message. But if you're not using a web protocol, if you're using any other protocol, you're going to have a big, long, ugly timeout as you try to make an IRC connection to OpenDNS's web server. Or as you try to send an email to OpenDNS's web server, or as you try to do anything else to OpenDNS's web server, because it sent you a success. So the program doesn't know that it didn't actually get a right answer and goes ahead and tries to do whatever it's trying to do, be that an FTP client, be that a chat client, be that anything at all. So it breaks applications if you don't actually tell them the truth. You're lying. It's giving an answer that's not correct.
Okay. And that's not according to the web protocol rules of the road.
It's not according to the DNS spec. And it mildly inconveniences your web traffic, but it causes more problems for other things as well. It's just wrong. I tolerate it because the OpenDNS guys are fantastic at their security stuff, and I'll take the inconvenience over insecurity.
Okay.
But now we have a new choice, as of this week. And this new choice does not have that downside. Our friends at Google have launched a public DNS service, and it does all of the security stuff that OpenDNS does, and maybe even a little more, and it does not break the rules. So your Firefox address bar works correctly again.
Oh, that's nice.
And actually, I'm personally, being a nerd, I'm really impressed by what they've done here. First off, they took IP addresses that are memorable. Right? The IP address of the free DNS server is 8.8.8.8.
Oh, even I could probably remember that.
Yeah. And if you want to set two servers, if you want a secondary, the secondary is 8.8.4.4.
Huh.
Both very memorable. So that's kind of cool. I like that for a start. It doesn't do the silly messing. It even has something they call preemptive caching, which means that when the cache is about to expire, they go ahead and fetch the result again and stick it back in the cache so that the cache never expires and no one really has to wait.
Wait, say that one more time.
Okay, so someone looks up a domain on Google's DNS servers. Google's DNS servers get back an answer with a TTL and it goes into the server's cache.
Sure, I remember that part.
It stays in the cache until it runs out of its time to live. But what Google do is, just before the time to live expires, even if no one asks them, they do another request to that domain anyway to update the record and get a new time to live.
So that would be so faster.
It never falls out of the cache. They preemptively recache before it's needed.
That seems like wasted energy. What if only one person ever asked for that website?
They say they don't do it for every domain. They just do it for popular domains.
Oh, okay. All right.
But the concept is exceptionally cool. They preempt you. They preemptively do the work so that when you need the work, you get a really quick answer. I love that.
Yeah.
What they also do is some security stuff that I think is just cool, like really cool. So I was saying that you have to match. Now you have to correctly guess the sequence number and the port number. And they do all that in Google. But the other thing is DNS is not case sensitive. So you can type in all capitals podfeet.com or in all lowercase podfeet.com and you will get the same answer back, because DNS doesn't give a monkeys a bit case.
Okay.
But remember I said that you get back the question you asked as part of your answer?
Right.
What Google do is they randomize the case. They randomly change some letters to uppercase and some letters to lowercase, send out the request, and only accept answers that give them back their randomized case.
What a silly little thing. I mean, that sounds a little kid's code, you know?
Yeah. But unpredictable. Even more work. Yeah, exactly. Right. So the spoofer now has to guess the sequence number, has to guess the source port, and has to guess how Google chose to randomly capitalize it.
Wow. I love sweet little solutions like that. That's cool.
It's thinking outside the box. I think it's fantastic. And they also stick in some random metadata, which they also expect to get back. So they've added two more levels of random that normal DNS servers don't have.
Huh.
And it's free.
Well, so there's no downside? Is it fattening? What's the...
I've been using it since Friday, which is not a huge long test because we're recording this on Sunday. But it is every bit as fast as OpenDNS was. It's every bit as accurate as OpenDNS was. And now my Firefox address bar works again.
Ah, that I will appreciate that. I never thought to complain about it because I just thought the world had changed.
No.
But that'll be nice to have back.
Yeah, the only I tolerated it with OpenDNS because I got security out of the bargain. But it was a trade-off I'd rather not make, so now I get security without the trade-off.
Now, one thing we should probably do at some point, or maybe we, you've got a link somewhere, is to tell people how they go change their DNS servers. Because that there's probably some document somewhere that says, here's how you do it on an airport, here's how you do it on a Linksys, here's how you do it on a D-Link, that sort of thing.
Do you want to know the ultimate irony?
What?
When I went to look how to change the DNS servers on my my router, the best document I got for changing DNS servers was an OpenDNS's website. So I used OpenDNS's instructions to change them to Google.
Oh, that's so sad. Well, I'm looking at my Airport search. Express right now, but I probably shouldn't change it while I'm connected to you.
No,
that would probably be a dumb thing to do.
It should be quite straightforward, though. You should just type them in somewhere, and then you're good to go.
Let's see. Oh, look at that. If I did, there's a little search box in the airport utility, and I typed in DNS, and there's internet connection DNS servers. There we go.
There you go. So I'll just change that, and then everyone in the house will be right.
Except you and I will be disconnected as soon as I hit update,
yeah, so
because it's
going to
restart the
it'll restart it changes the firmware and then recycles the airport, so don't do it now.
Now, if somebody were doing this, it's probably a good idea to write down the ones you had just in case you do something stupid, you know, because it's hard to get back.
Yes, because you now can't use the internet.
Or before you do it, look up the DNS entry for Google so at least you can start searching, right?
Well, no, because then you won't be able to resolve the answers. No, before you start, you take a screenshot of the current settings, you print it out. You print out the instructions for changing it that you find maybe on OpenDNS's site, and then you change it. And then if all else fails, you just put it back the way you found it. There is a very small number of ISPs who block all DNS servers apart from their own.
Ooh, that's
which means
rude.
It's very rude, and I would change ISP over that kind of tomfoolery, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I know there's one or two UK ones that do it because Stu Helm from the International Mac podcast ran into that with his old ISP. So
why
he followed
would they
my advice.
That? That's horrible.
I have no idea.
That's like saying you have
I know why to do it. It's because they want to do what OpenDNS do.
Oh, and get
the
ads.
They want their ads, so they get the revenue. Yeah, so they make you less secure so they can make money off you. Sorry, not good enough.
No, I guess not. Well, this is pretty cool. I'll have to give it a try. It's possible we won't notice, you know, instant, you know, speed blowing our hair back, right?
Oh, completely, because OpenDNS is pretty damnable snappy, and you and me we're both OpenDNS users.
Okay, so if people do this and they don't notice a big difference, just sleep easier at night.
Yeah, exactly. You have good security now, and it may be a teeny bit faster.
Yeah.
But your address bar will work again if you've been using OpenDNS.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm just going to go start putting in typos right and left. Actually, I'll probably end up at a bunch of porn sites if I do that. I better watch out.
You should be careful with those kind of things. But no, I just to test it, I just typed in CNN and hit return. And hey, presto, I ended up at CNN.com.
Oh, that's sweet. One of the reasons that's really good is sometimes things like, I remember the first time I was trying to help my brother find the NBA website, and it wasn't NBA.com. It was like NBA.net or something like that, the National Basketball Association. And I remember thinking, as soon as I figured out that this worked now, is I could just type in NBA and it would just figure it out for me. So
there you go.
Awesome. All right, Bart, this has been a good lesson. It was a little rugged in the middle there, I got to tell you.
Yeah,
a little trouble in the middle.
We go into the difficult stuff and then we come back out.
And bring it on home.
All the good stuff, yeah.
All right, Bart. Well, I think we're still on schedule for next week, but in 2 weeks, Bart is flying solo. He is going to be running the show. So
it's just going to be chit.
Right. So, I'd like to put the shout out to people if they are interested in sending in some reviews for Bart to play where he doesn't have to come up with an hour's worth of content all on his own. That would be swell. I've already got one.
Approve.
I'm going to say. I thought you might like that. I already got one from somebody that is going to be, it's not real time based, so it'll be perfect in a couple of weeks. And maybe we can get some more people to send in some reviews. You know, Evan's usually good for one, isn't he?
Well, he is now.
All right, Bart. Well, we will talk to you next week.
Indeedy. Until then, happy computing. Wait, actually, stop. Wait, no, not happy computing yet. I need to pull you up on some pronunciations.
Oh, no, no. Look at the time. Look at the time. We've really got to get going, Bart. We're out of time.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, but your Belgian place names are just not good enough. You don't deserve the chocolate.
Oh, come on. Having been one who's never sent me any chocolate, I'm not sure you're in a position to say that.
That's a fair point. I'll be over there at Easter, though. I'll pick you up some then. Yeah. But anyway, it's Mechelen would be the name of the town where your chocolate started from.
Mechelen.
And then they went all the way, yeah.
Then but where it's spelled Michelin.
Nothing to do with tires, nothing to do with big men made of tires. It's Mechelen. It's
Mechelen.
It's the closest big town to where I grew up in Belgium.
All right. Is that the only one I got wrong?
It's the one I noticed. I don't know what else you got wrong. That's the one that I noticed. It's like, that's my hometown. How dare you say it wrong?
All right. Now can we have happy computing?
Yes, now we can compute happily. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you'll come join us sometime in the live show on Sunday nights, 5 p.m. GMT-8 at podfeet.com/live. We have a ball in the chat room goofing around between recordings. Well, they're goofing around while I'm recording and paying pretty much no attention to me. They're talking to each other mostly. The crowd is very welcoming, though, and it's friendly in there. We have a lot of fun. If you're too shy to join in the live chat, send your emails in with dumb questions, compliments, and even complaints if you must, to allison@podfeet.com. If you're feeling bold, give recording a product review a try. The iPhone recorder actually does a great job. Come on, go for it. You got opinions? Send them in. Well, that's enough for me. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.